We're talking about listening to cities, listening in cities, and learning how to open our ears. So I asked if you can hear segregation. The answer is yes. You can hear racism, too. Sonic intolerance, which can be deadly. In 2012, 17-year-old Jordan Davis and some friends pulled up at a Florida gas station. There was another guy there, also getting gas, a white man.
We're at a gas station an average of 3 to 5 minutes. We're used to hearing sounds coming and going and blaring at us.
Sound historian Jennifer Stover.
The white man Michael Dunn had stopped at a Florida gas station and decided that he would go over to a Jeep of young black teenagers and tell them that they absolutely had to turn their music down. They said no. This is a shared space. This need to silence that sound led to him deciding to shoot into the Jeep, killing Jordan Davis, who's only 17. It was called the loud music trial in the press, as if this were just a case about loud music. The young men were listening to hip hop, a song by Lil Reese. He described it later as rap crap. And there was something about the way that those young men were taking up space at the gas station and using sound to take up space that really called attention to Michael Dunn's feelings about race and who belonged where, how people should sound, how people should listen to music, and what kind of music is acceptable in public space. He murdered someone over that.
Jennifer Stover is a sound studies scholar. She teaches at Binghamton University, and she grew up in Southern California, one of the most diverse regions in America. She was an early hip-hop fan, and it was when she was going out to concerts and clubs that she first started noticing what she calls the sonic color line.
This was about, I would say, 2007, maybe, 2006. And it was at the moment when LA's downtown was changing from the site where brown and poor people lived in the city to its current kind of gentrified state. So all of these old factories and empty office buildings were being transformed into lofts and condominiums, and folks on Skid Row were being pushed out. I had gone to a concert at the Hollywood Bowl. I'd actually gone to see Isaac Hayes at the Hollywood Bowl. As often happens in LA, I got stranded downtown in the middle of the night waiting for the bus. And what I heard coming from the doorways at 2 a.m. was classical music, really high volume classical music. And I was standing there by myself going, well, what is happening here? And then I realized that music was being played to keep people from sleeping in the doorway. So it's kind of like a hostile architecture, right? Sound being used as a deterrent. But then because it's quote-unquote classical music, it can't possibly be noise, no matter how loud you have it. This actually ups the class feeling of people in the building while really being this kind of hostile keep-out sound.
So this is basically sonic gentrification. Affluent white people have moved in and feel like, well, now we get to decide what's noise and what isn't.
Exactly. Also, just the idea that when you buy into a place, when you move into a neighborhood, the neighborhood has to conform to your ideas about what a neighborhood sounds like, rather than an adjustment to the sounds that are around you.
So what's an example of, say, a public debate around noise that you think actually was a racial debate?
Another example of racial politics operating through sound occurred in New York City in Harlem, and it involved a drum circle taking place outside at Marcus Garvey Park on Sunday afternoons. This drum circle had been there since the late 60s and came out of the Black Power movement and Black Arts movement. And in 2007, a condo building that had sold and been refurbished, rents raised, and white middle-class people moving into a neighborhood that has historically been Black and Puerto Rican, there began to be increasing noise complaints by the residents to their condo board and to the police. This sound became something that the white condo residents really fixated on. And that is actually probably occurring in many forms in cities across the country.
So I was thinking, you know, the history of big cities like New York is in a lot of ways a history of displacement. As populations shift and move from one neighborhood to another, it sounds like you could almost write the history of cities in sound.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the things that I study quite intensely. I've actually looked at New York in the 40s when there was another moment of upheaval after the war, when Puerto Ricans were moving from Puerto Rico to the States. And you find in the newspapers at the time, like the New York Times, letters from white people talking about their Puerto Rican neighbors, but saying things like, the city's become an audio slum.
Wow.
And I study a sound artist named Tony Schwartz, who in the 1940s lived in Hell's Kitchen, right near where Lincoln Center was about to be developed. So he lived through the displacement and the destruction of San Juan Hill, which was a largely Black and Latino neighborhood that was razed completely to make Lincoln Center.
They come by and they watch us dancing out on the streets, and they think it's terrible and disgusting. But, you know, they do the same thing, too, only they do it in the nightclubs.
He has recordings from that era of that neighborhood and actually made the argument through a radio show that here we are destroying thousands of musical performances taking place every night to create a space for one very elite performance happening every night. Who has the power to control the kind of sounds that are made in the city? And also, who has to live with the noise of all of this construction being built?
Wow.
Whether it's the Lincoln Center or the Cross Bronx Expressway, certain sounds, very loud sounds, we're supposed to be able to tolerate because they're sold as being good for everybody when they're serving only a certain population.
Mm. We've been talking about sonic prejudice, but I wonder if there are ways in which communities of color or disenfranchised neighborhoods have also used sound to define and carve out a space. I guess I was thinking that isn't that part of the story of the rise of hip-hop in the Bronx in the 70s?
Very much so. I've also researched Harlem in the 1940s and the way that Black and brown people, Black people and Puerto Ricans, had conversations about noise in the newspaper and conversations about how do we share space. Everybody celebrates sometimes. It's not that certain people are noisemakers and certain people aren't. And you'll see from that period, the Amsterdam News urging Black readers to be more tolerant, say, of Spanish accents in their community. That, hey, when we moved up from the South, we were discriminated against for our Southern speech. So we don't want to think of Spanish as something that doesn't belong or is noisy. And hip-hop is another place where sound brought Black and Puerto Rican people together. DJs like Afrika Bambaataa use sounds from wherever, the television from Europe and things like Kraftwerk and his mom's record collection, bringing all those things and creating these new sounds to create a space of togetherness and a way to actually envision a new community versus what was called the burned out Bronx by many people in New York City at the time.
You must hear and read about examples of this all the time. What's the most recent example where you thought, yep, there it is again?
Actually, there was a story of a woman in the summer in North Carolina, a doctor. This was covered by the Washington Post in May. She was at home celebrating good news. She had just heard she was pregnant. She had just received a prestigious cardiology fellowship. And she turned on her Spotify playlist on a Saturday afternoon, 3 p.m., turned on her playlist of 90s hip hop. Things like Juvenile and Notorious B.I.G., Puff Daddy, and you know, she said she listened to it for an hour and was feeling joyful and dancing, turned it off, sat down to watch the news, and then there's a knock at her door, and her neighbors had called the police on her for playing loud music. Instead of ignoring it and saying, hey, it's Saturday, someone's in a good mood downstairs, or knocking on her door, again, creating community relationships, mm-hmm. having a conversation about it. They just went straight to the police, and the police abruptly knocked on the door, scared her in her own home, made her feel like, even though she has the right to be there, the class status to be in this particular place, she didn't belong in this neighborhood, that her white neighbors don't tolerate her ways of being and are consciously listening for it. We can also amplify sounds we hear. The more we fixate on certain sounds, the more we begin to notice and attune to them.
Right. So it's a story over and over again of people being silenced, literally.
Yes.
Wow. You're opening up this whole kind of language that to me seems to be about the ethics of listening, or the ethics of hearing, moving from sonic prejudice to a model of sonic inclusiveness.
If that is a legacy that I can leave, I would be honored and appreciative. I really encourage people to stop and observe reactions that we've come to understand as natural or immediate to sound. Why am I upset at this particular moment that my neighbor is playing a certain kind of music? Why am I upset that my neighbors are using their front yard to have a party versus their backyard? Sound triggers a lot of these deeply held feelings about race and class. And the way we think about race and class influences what we hear. And if we can really begin to break that automatic assumption, a lot of things can change.
Jennifer Lynn Stover teaches at Binghamton University. She's the author of The Sonic Color Line and also editor-in-chief of the sound studies blog, Sounding Out. So, time to rethink what you consider noise. Remember our guide, David Rothenberg? He's been thinking about that too.
Noise traditionally is a sound we don't like. It could easily be a sound someone else likes. Electric guitar makes a really pure sound, but we want to plug it into distortion, feedback, and fuzz boxes. We like this noisiness. We like this buzziness. The same thing you find in urban noise. People go out and seek the loudest possible places to dance and try and talk in loud bars and things like that. People actually like that. Sometimes we like loud sounds. Sometimes we think it's noise or too much noise, but other times we actually enjoy it. A lot of it's our attitude toward what's around us.
So what happens if you lean into the noise? We'll find out next. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.